It is so good to have Susan Simmons-Smith back with us. Her initial career was therapist with a Jungian bent, and then she became ordained an Episcopal priest, and then she became the canon to the ordinary for Bishop Mays. And this past two years, she began to have dreams that led her to a very specific ashram in India to go stay for considerable time at a shot. And she now has been three different times. So she's going to share with us something of the being led there and where the journey has taken us. And then she will also, for those who would like, have an experiential workshop this afternoon. Susan.
Good morning. It's so wonderful to be back with you again and to be in this place with this community. I'm going to make a couple of announcements before I start my talk. The first one is that I'm going to take a group to India next year. I'm in the process of firming up the dates and the price with Poe Travel Agency. If you're interested, there's an announcement about it on the tables back there. And I'm going to meet with anybody that wants to talk more about it at 1:15, right after lunch in the fireplace lounge. So if you think you might be interested, or you know somebody that might be, or you just want to hear about it, feel free to join then. The second announcement is I'm going to talk about a variety, different ashrams and different websites and music CDs and books. You don't need to worry about writing that down because you have it on a handout if you have not already discovered it. So this blue handout, the first page is a printout from the Seedwork website about prayer and meditation techniques. And the second page is a list of resources, websites, books, CDs, and I'll be referring to those. So don't worry that you're going to lose them, because you're not going to. And let's see if my husband is here. Is Rick? Okay, I want you to meet my friend, lover, and companion of 40 years. Rick, will you stand up? Rick is the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the medical school, and he is a fabulous husband, a wonderful father, and really fun, especially when we get out of town, the most fun. So I'm grateful for his love and support, and as some of you have said to me, you've told so many stories about the guy, we deserve to get to meet him, so... All right. I want to start by thanking you first for your ministry. For those of you that have been in the dream work business for a long time, you're well established and you're well known for doing this work. For those of you that are just getting started, you are having an effect on people that are around you. First of all, you're having an effect because as your consciousness goes up, your vibrational frequency changes and you are affecting everybody around you, the people in the grocery store, somebody in the library. Because you are doing your work, the love of Christ and the love of the divine is bigger on this planet. Spoken or not spoken, your vibrational frequency is changing, and that's helping redeem and restore the planet. Those of you that tell somebody that you're coming here, you are affecting people that you don't even know. Somebody in your church has heard that you read a book on dreams, or you're having a book study, or they know that you came to this conference. It opens up the possibility of wisdom from the unconscious for all the people that are in your posse. And I thank you for doing that. Next, I want to say that I believe that we incarnate in soul clusters. And I believe that we are all part of a particular soul cluster. And you have parts of your soul cluster back home and parts of your soul cluster other places. And I believe that each person in that soul cluster has a particular function or a particular task. And that when you are you doing what you do well, you are doing that on behalf of your soul cluster. So because we're really not separated, because we truly are one, because at an energetic level there is no separation between Jeremy and me, we are just appearing right now as if we are in two physical bodies that appear to be separate. So each part of that soul cluster is acting on behalf of the larger cluster. As I start to tell you these stories about India, to the degree that you are able to not think about this as having happened to Susan Sim Smith as an individual, and to the degree that you are able to think about this as this happened to you because part of your soul cluster went on these missionary trips that I'm going to tell you about, that I think is the most appropriate way to think about it. When Chelsea plays music, that is the part of my body that is playing that music. That is a part of your body that is playing that music because we are one. Okay, enough introductory comments. How many of you meditate? Okay, that's good. Meditation in general moves us into an altered state of consciousness. It allows us to listen not only to the divine, but to our best self. Sometimes when I'm meditating and I'm thinking I'm hearing God, I will occasionally get a little tease message saying, you know, you're just listening to yourself. And I will say back to what to the universe, well, it's a self that has not been talking until I got this quiet, I'll tell you that much. So just like we are not separated from one another, at the level of meditation, we are not separated from the divine, because our highest self and the divine are one. Meditation allows us to get more energy, to receive correction. It calms us down, and we receive downloads of new information. Information we've never heard of before and that nobody taught us in the First Methodist Church in Martre, Arkansas. Dreams and meditation have similar purposes, but they are a little bit different. In dreams, we receive a dialogue with the unconscious, a dialogue with our best self, and a dialogue with the divine. Meditation strengthens dream recall. And in addition, we can be taught in dreams techniques for meditation, and we can be taught in meditation new techniques for meditation. About 12 years ago, right before I was ordained, I went through a huge change in my meditation process. And it started with a dream in which I was told that I was now ready to swim in the waters of Ornaj. And I had no idea what that meant. But I got up and worked with it and messed around with it, and over a period of a few days, I began to understand that the dream was teaching me a new way to meditate, and that I was to swim in the waters of making a sound. And I began to experiment with making a sound when I meditated. And I practiced it and fiddled with it and experimented with it over a period of a year or so. But the literal idea of now you need to work with sound in your meditation did not come from a workshop or a book. It came from a dream. Many other downloads about how to meditate have come to me in the last 12 years, mostly now directly in meditation. I will be told, now you are to meditate this way, and I'll be taught a way to meditate that is not anything that I've ever read about, but what I believe is that we are each pre-programmed with a CD in our brain about how we need to meditate. And that when we're ready, that CD ignites and you practice one way and you are able to do what the task and functions are in that vibrational frequency, then you're given a new way. There are some differences for me in dreams and meditation. I had a dream that dreaming is like going to the post office box once a day to open up the post office box and take out a letter from the divine postman. So letters from God. So I wake up in the morning and I go to the post office box and I pull out the mail and I read the letter or letters between the divine and me. Dreams are often, but as you know, not always symbolic. Sometimes they're not symbolic, but they're usually symbolic. They usually require decoding. They work with poetry, symbol, myths, and archetypes. Meditation, once I made this huge change in the way I meditate 12 years ago, meditation for me now has become more like email. Email is that I can get the communication any time of the day or night. When I check in by going into this type of meditation, I can receive the information. I choose the time. Sometimes it is coded and comes symbolically, but at this particular phase of my life, much of the information is not coded. It's straight out sentences, and you're going to hear a lot of that as I tell this India business. So mixed in the last year when the India business has been going on have been what I would call regular nighttime dreams that still needed to be decoded, mixed in with straight stuff, just straight information. Back to the difference between meditation and dreams for me. Also in meditation, we can download large amounts of information at one time. So both dreams and meditation can give us access to techniques and ongoing teaching about how to meditate. During this process of me learning how to meditate, I was told that I had to make an energy body strong enough to tolerate the levels of frequency where I was going to be traveling. So for several months, what I did in the meditation was I visualized that I was in various kinds of bodies of light containers, like I would be inside a pea pod, and I would strengthen the pea pod by encircling it with light, or I would be inside a suitcase. But I was taught that I needed to do that. I was taught you're about to travel into frequencies where you can't travel without a stronger light body. And I didn't read that in a book. Nobody gave it to me in a class. I was told that I needed to do that. During this time, I was also given numbers and letters with which to meditate. And the numbers and letters changed over time, over the last 12 years. So I would get very attached to these particular numbers and letters because they were teaching me stuff and I didn't want to leave them. And once I was meditating to those numbers and letters and I was told a new number and I was like, no, I don't want to switch. And I would go back to my old ones and I kept being given this new number. That particular number that I was being given then was 96, which is not the number now. And I would say, no, I don't want to change. And I was told, okay, if you would like to ride on the slow, decrepit train to Zurich, just stay on your old numbers and letters. But if you would like to get on the fast track, go here. So basically what the unconscious was saying is you have reaped all the benefit that you need from this way of meditating. You have harvested. I think what happens is when I would meditate to certain numbers and letters, I was taken into a room, so to speak. And I was harvesting everything I needed to know out of that space. Then I was being given a different way to meditate. Okay, let's see. All right, now we'll look at a few slides. As most of you know, this is the Arkansas House of Prayer. A group of people and I raised the money to build an interfaith meditation center with Bishop Larry May's blessing and his help. So it's built on 5.5 acres of land next door to St. Margaret's Episcopal Church. And the interior of it is just for silence so that people of all faiths are invited to come here and say their prayers. This is the pre-meditation room. So you come into this beautiful room and you may leave your purse or your shoes or whatever. And then you go from there into this round meditation room. And there's a circle of earth. And then there's a dome, and we're hoping that the visuals will say the divine is the divine of the earth and also the divine of the spiritual realm. And this circle of earth goes 16 feet down into the ground, and on the day that we dedicated the building, people from all the world religions brought soil from the places where they pray. They dug dirt from under where the Buddhists are doing their meditations, and they brought that, and a group of children mixed that into the middle. So I'm going to leave that slide up there for a minute. Little did I know when I started this project that I was going to end up with more work in the interfaith area than I had thought. Okay, the next image that I'm going to show you is we have a budding, very potentially famous young neuroscientist that has married into our family. We have one daughter, and she has married a wonderful, brilliant young neuroscientist who is studying brain imaging. The next two slides are from a part of his research. The brain that you're going to see is the brain of a friend of Jeremy Taylor's and mine. His name is the Reverend George McLeod. He was the minister of the Sausalito Presbyterian Church for 25 years. He taught me to meditate in 1979 when I couldn't find anybody to talk to in Arkansas, and I joined the Sausalito Presbyterian Church and kept going out there to learn this kind of stuff. So this is George's brain. He came to Arkansas. He's our daughter's godfather, and he was there to do the wedding, and Josh did some research. Josh is the son-in-law. Josh did some research on George's brain while George was meditating. And I want to tell you a little bit about what he found. Jeremy and George McLeod were like in one of the original clergy dream groups. Is that right? Okay. So this is George, with George's permission, this is George's brain. Okay? So the first one is the top one. Let me get turned over to my Josh notes so I'll know what I'm doing. All right. The top one is during meditation. Now you can still hear me? The top one is during meditation. The bottom one is during rest. These images show areas of the brain that are communicating with the posterior cingulate cortex, which is a neural region that is highly involved in self-something and making judgments and self-relevance. Now, I want to say a word or two about, I'm going to translate that a little bit. We know that there's not a spot in the brain that is tied to meditation. We know that the brain actually works in neural networks. So the old idea of the brain is that this is here, that's there, and that's there. The new idea of the brain is that there's certain networks that activate for certain functions. The cingulate cortex, the posterior cingulate cortex, is a part of the brain that is part of the network that is highly involved in us making decisions about what is relevant or not relevant, what is meaningful or not meaningful. So during meditation, you are having all these non-relevant thoughts, like, did I feed the dog? Am I going to run out of gas when I get in the car? Did I turn on the laundry? Did I remember to bring my Tibetan bells to the Kanuga conference? So when you're doing your meditation, you are having all these thoughts that are irrelevant to the task of meditation. And you are then returning to whatever your focal point is, whether it's a mantra or a visual thing or a breathing or a number or a sound. And so the thing that they found that was really very exciting is that when you think of meditation, you think that possibly you're resting. But what they actually found is that you are working extremely hard to discern what is relevant and not to focus on all these other things. You can see it in the picture. The top one, let me show you one more. It's even clearer in the next one. You can see it actually in both of them. In the meditation one on the top and the resting one on the bottom, look how hard the brain is working in the top picture. Basically, most of the brain has been pirated to help with the task of meditation, because the majority of the brain is lit up. Not all of it, but most of it is lit up. So what's really happening in meditation is that the person is actually working pretty darn hard. So anyway, we'll go on from that. If you ask me too many questions on that, I'm going to have to plead ignorance. You know most of what I know, but I thought the visuals were really good. That it's work. It is work to meditate. You are not hanging out. You are working. Okay. Now, let's get into India a little bit. I had always assumed that someday I would go to India when my husband and I would go there on a vacation. But what actually happened was that in November of 2009, I woke up in the middle of the night with the word Pondicherry, and I just got up and wrote it in my dream journal. And two or three nights later, I woke up with a dream with just the word Pondicherry. And that continued to happen for the whole month of November. I thought Pondicherry might be a fruit tree in Florida, for all I knew. And eventually I decided that I was dreaming it enough that I better go Google it and see what this is about. And the first thing that came up when I Googled it was a couple's travelogue, and they had been to Pondicherry to an ashram there that I'd never heard of. And they said they'd been all over India looking at ashrams, and this was their favorite one. And it was the ashram of Sri Aurobindo. And I had never heard of Sri Aurobindo. Now, some of my old hippie buddies say, you actually heard of Sri Aurobindo. You've just gotten old enough that you don't remember that you heard of him. So I don't remember ever hearing anything about Sri Aurobindo. But I looked at the website, and I thought, well, that's nice. Ho-hum, if I ever go to India, I will go there. I continued in December to have very intense dreams about some ashram in India. And again, I was not thinking of going to India. And eventually, I ordered one of Sri Aurobindo's books. And one of them has a photograph of him on the cover. And I left it out on a table in the living room. And as I walked past it one day, I heard out loud, there is your teacher. And I thought, oh, holy Toledo, you know, just what I need, a teacher in India. Because I have a couple of buddies that have had teachers in India for 30 years. And frankly, just between you and me, I've never really admired it. I've always thought, oh, God, you know, would they quit? Just I don't need to hear any more about that. It's not been anything I have admired or aspired to. So, you know, you always get it put back in your face a little. So I hear, here's your teacher. So I start reading Aurobindo's books. And I hear in the meditation, you're going to go to India to help your colony. That would be the posse. That would be the soul cluster. And I'm thinking, well, you know, maybe I will go someday, but it's not around the corner. So by the time I get through the holidays and I get into January, I cannot sit in meditation or go to sleep without dreaming something about the Sri Aurobindo ashram and about Pondicherry. And eventually one night, I have a dream where somebody says to me, go now, or forever hold back your choir of angels. And I wake up and I think, holy Toledo, the choir of angels to me would be my joy, my blessing, my excitement. And I say to my husband, you know what, I think I need to go to India. And he's like going, oh my Lord. So anyway, That day, I do my meditation, and in the meditation, I hear, get your visa and go through every door as fast as you can open them. So in other words, don't race to knock the doors down, but get the visa and start going through the doors. Well, I had a whole bunch of frequent flyer points saved, and I call, and the lady says, I thought if you went to India, you need to stay a month. I don't know why I thought that, but I say to the lady, you know, I'm going to go to India. Will you help me use my frequent flyer points? She said, you're not going to be able to use your frequent flyer points because it takes a year, blah, blah, blah. I said, well, just start. Here's some dates that I'm free. Just start here and go through the whole year until you find a time that there's a ticket. So she says, we're probably not going to find one even today. Anyway, you know how it's going to end. In 20 minutes, she comes back, and she says, how would you like to leave March the 16th? And you can be gone 3 weeks, and I can get you back. I said, okay, done. So let's do it. So to make a long story short, I just went because I was told. Then I started investigating this ashram, and I learned that they have several guest houses. And I read around, and I found the guest house that people recommended, and I started emailing people at this guest house asking if I could come and stay, and they said, we are only for spiritual development, no tourists, you can't come. So I sent them stuff back, and I tried to document that I was a spiritual seeker, and they would send me something back saying, you need to speak to Debetius, he's the one that talks to the religious type. So I tried to get something going with Debetius. And eventually I sold them on the idea that I was not a tourist. And I sent them my itinerary. Look, I'm coming to Pondicherry, and I'm going home. That's it. So they gave me a room in this guest house. And around that time, I start getting excited about going. I still have no idea why I'm going. And I eat lunch with Larry Mays, and he said, I know exactly why you're going. I've been looking at that Aurobindo website, and I get it. And I said, why don't you go? You get it. I don't get it. And at the end of the lunch, he says, you remember that Robert Johnson went to India every year? And I said, yeah, I had forgotten that. So I go home and I research Robert Johnson in India, and there's a website. And he is sitting in a room in the guest house where I am going to be staying. Now, they have about 10 guest houses, but I am staying in the one where Robert Johnson went off and on for umpteen years. And I'm saying to myself then, I have no idea why I'm going, but there's a reason, okay? So I'm going. So basically what's happened is I've made 3 trips to India in 12 months to 3 different places. I was given specific places to go and specific dates to go for very specific reasons, none of which I understood anything about when I left. On one of the trips, I ended up going 2 places, so I'll tell you about that in a minute. Okay, so I get my little backpack, and I'm 60 years old. I'm not a teenager anymore. But I load up, and I tear out, and I manage to get there, and it was, you know, those of you that have been to India, how many of you have been to India? Quite a few of you. I mean, it's an experience just getting there. But I get to the ashram, and I was told in a meditation before I left that part of the reason that I was being sent was that my level of joy was going to be increased while I was there. And I remember thinking, you know, why do I need more joy? I think I have enough. It's okay. But I just go. And there are 50 rooms in this ashram guest house, and there's a sign over each room, compassion, peace. Of course, what happens? They take me to room 25, and there's a big sign over the door that says joy. And I go, okay, you know, I still don't understand why I'm here. You have to sleep under a mosquito net. I get under the mosquito net that night, and before I go to bed, I pray, and I say, divine, show me why I'm here. I surrender. I'm here to serve you. I'll do whatever you want. I go to sleep at 1 o'clock in the morning. There are 4 lights in the room. One of them comes on spontaneously. And I wake up when the light comes on. And it's the light that is over the photograph of Sri Aurobindo and the mother in the room. It is lit up. And I'm going, okay, I'm going to surrender. I'm going to learn everything I can learn about Sri Aurobindo. And I proceeded at that point to just give myself to the experience of learning about Sri Aurobindo. Somewhere during that process, I had a dream, and I'm on a bus, and on the bus are all of these people that I know, and the person at the front of the bus says, hey, I want you to meet your cousin. And I said, okay. And from the back of the bus comes Sri Aurobindo, and the man at the front says to me, this is your beloved cousin, Aurobindo. And so part of what I came to understand, in fact, Aurobindo started showing up in my dreams then, and he said to me directly. Part of what I understand is that Sri Aurobindo is a human. He's not a divine incarnate, but I did get to meet one of those later, which I'll tell you about later. But it's not Aurobindo. Aurobindo is a human. And what he said to me is, I am on the spiritual step that you need to learn about. And the step that you need to go to, I have figured everything out that's on that one step. Like, I'm not further down. I'm not the divine incarnate. But I am a step ahead of where you are, and I know stuff that you don't know. So I just start saying to myself, okay, download it, baby. Let's have it. Let's show me the stuff. So I started having incredible mystical spiritual experiences. And I'll just give you an example of a few of them. The guest house itself is so unbelievable. It is like a lab school in consciousness. Everywhere you go, there are signs about consciousness. You drink water, and it talks about the spirituality of water and the spirituality of drinking. You're going up the stairs, and there are signs about how going up the stairs strengthens your spirituality. There are signs about how to relax before you go to sleep. There's stuff about the food. The people that work in the ashram are all ashram members. So you're in kind of an Aurobindo lab school while you're there. So just staying in that guest house itself would have been enough. Dayenu, it would have been enough to see me from here to heaven, just what happened in the guest house. So there's a beautiful garden in front of the guest house, which I'll show you the garden. Let's see if I can get to it. Okay, that's the garden in front of the guest house. And the picture's a little weak on the right side, but that's the Indian Ocean. So the guest house is on the ocean, all right? And one day I was walking around in the garden, and this man that's an ashram member who runs the little bicycle rental place there came up to me and he said, have you meditated in Sri Aurobindo's bedroom? And I'm thinking, I am not into that kind of stuff. He said, I want you to have the opportunity. And I think, okay, you know, I've said I'll make myself available, so how do I get in? And he said, well, you can't get in, because you can only go in if it's your birthday, and it's not your birthday, is it? And I said, no. He said, there are two old women that sit at the foot of the stairs at Aurobindo's ashram. See, I wasn't sleeping at the ashram. I was sleeping in a guest house. You go talk to those old women tomorrow at 8, and you tell them that you want to go in there for purposes of meditation. And you get there early, and you do blah, blah. He told me what to do. So I think, okay. So I go, and the ladies take me to somebody. They give me a ticket. I go to sit with 15 people in his bedroom, and I'm thinking, okay, I go into the meditation. As soon as I go into the meditation, the room becomes filled with the color tanzanite. Tanzanite is the color in Connie Kaplan's work, and I have a reference point for how you can get her stuff. Tanzanite is the color for trust and initiation. So I'm learning to trust more, and I'm being initiated into something. So the whole room becomes tanzanite. And Aurobindo shows up in my meditation room. He says, I got you here, girly. Now what are you going to do? And I go back into the meditation. I basically say, whatever you tell me, you know. I do the meditation, and he gives me a new number, a new meditation number. And I'm going to flash forward on the number, because I think I will forget this if I don't do it now. I'm in a dream group that I've been in for about 10 years, 15 years, whatever. There are only four of us. One of the women in there has been studying Connie Kaplan's work for however many years Connie's been teaching. I go back to my dream group, and she says, Connie has taught me something new. She has taught me that when you look at the numbers in your spiritual principles, you subtract certain ones from one another, and you get your I am principle number. And your I am principle number is your spiritual principle that you're supposed to see the world from and live out of all the time. I said, could you do my numbers? She does my numbers, and she gives me the number that Aurobindo gave me in his bedroom a month before. So at that point, I'm understanding that there's a spiritual thing that is unfolding and that I'm supposed to be part of it. It took me a while to get safe, feeling safe in India. But after I'd been there about 10 days, I started kind of feeling safe and figuring out you could go and meditate at the samadhi at the ashram at night. I would do that at night. One night a week, you could go meditate at the playground. I had amazing things happen to me. It was like I was a religious experience waiting to happen everywhere I went. And the intention there is for that. So after I had been there a few days, maybe 9 or 10 days, I started hearing some other people that I had met say, we're being asked to leave the guest house because the 100th anniversary of Aurobindo's arrival into Pondicherry is going to be happening. And we've been told that we're supposed to leave. And I said, well, they're not going to ask me to leave because I've got my email saying that I can stay these days. You know, I'm like this little American orderly. I've got my email. They've told me I can do whatever. So I'm not feeling anxious yet because nobody's messed with me. Let's see. Okay. So, this is sort of a distraction, but it's a wonderful one. I toured a handicapped sheltered place, and the people there had they dyed silk, and they had received a new stainless steel tub for dyeing silk, and they all took hours to build beautiful mandalas on the ground with chalk around the stainless steel tub, because that's India. The spirituality is thick, it's everywhere, and even if it's a business, you stop and give thanks. Okay, so let me see what's next. Okay, let me go back a second. All right. So in the background, there's this rumbling about people are going to have to leave, but, you know, not me. I'm squeaky clean. I've got my email, right? So I also learn that Aurobindo's partner, the mother, after Aurobindo died in 1950, in 1968, she heard the vision to start an intentional, experimental, utopian community called Auroville. And it started in 1968. People from 124 countries came when they did the groundbreaking. Auroville exists right now as a community of 2,160 people from 45 nations and from all the world religions. And they are experimenting with how can you live together and get along. And that's one of the main places when I take this people on a trip to India. Auroville is one of the main places we're going to go. So when the mother started the idea of building this experimental community, she said the heart and soul of the building needs to be a meditation center. So in the heart and soul of Auroville is this meditation center. And a person is about... You see the person over there, so you get an idea of how big this building is. So on the inside of the building, you walk in and you're inside this sphere, and this sphere is covered with apricot-colored marble. And it may be one of the most beautiful physical buildings I've ever been in my whole life. And so I go out, it's 30 minutes out from Pondicherry in the country at this intentional community. So I go out and you go in and they give you the directions about how to use the building. The rules and the intention about how to use the building are identical to the rules of the Arkansas House of Prayer. There's no difference between the two. They're cousins. They're just located in different geographies. So that's mind-blowing, because the intention is for silence, stillness, and concentration. It's for people of all the world religions. There's no singing, no yoga, no liturgy, no worship. Nothing can happen in the space except silence. So this is the inside. Inside the dome is the inside the ball, and the meditation room is up in the top of the dome. And you go up a glass and marble spiral staircase to get up into the meditation room. So you're walking inside an apricot-colored dome to get into this room. And the silence in the room is unbelievable. So about 60 people can sit in there. It's white marble. Supposedly the largest man-made quartz or human-made piece of glass made by a German company is in the middle. And there's a solar panel on the top of this round building. The building is called the Matre Mandire, something about the Divine Mother. And the solar panel moves so that natural light can come through there. So the first time I went in it, the intensity of the silence, it was like you could not help but meditate. You had no choice. You were taken into such a deep, deep level of meditation. And I had two experiences in there that I want to tell you about briefly. The first time I went in there, I was deeply into the meditation, and the glass ball in my mind's eye transformed into Christ's head with his crown of thorns. And part of what is being taught at Auroville is about unity consciousness. How can we maintain our separate religions but still know something that we are unified? So in my meditation, the glass ball becomes Christ's head, and he looks at me and he says, "Would you like to know who's in charge of unity consciousness?" And I say, "Yes." And he says, "I am." And I think, very interesting. I must need to hear this for reasons that I don't understand. So I am holding his presence, the presence of Christ, in the middle of that room, and I'm understanding that, you know, in Scripture it says that Christ was with God at the time of creation, before the Christ consciousness incarnated into Jesus, that the Christ consciousness was with God in the beginning and is with God now and will be with God forever. And what I'm hearing in that is that it's the Christ consciousness that is behind the scenes in all the world religions on planet Earth and in every situation, seeking to redeem and restore and make the planet whole. One other quick experience there. One of the spiritual principles that I learned about while I was there and studying Aurobindo is the spiritual principle of immobility. And immobility means you find your stillness no matter what is happening on the outside. And I'm telling you, that is not easy. And I was like the newest kid on the block practicing it. It was easier to practice it in this room. Before you go in, they tell you if anybody coughs, just go outside, we'll meet you out there and give you a bottle of water. Well, I was in there meditating, and I was so deeply into the silence, and somebody started coughing to beat the band, and I could hear them, but it didn't interrupt the stillness. That's the first time in my life that I wouldn't have like gone, "Why are you coughing?" But I was able to hold the stillness, and the thought went through my mind, this is how Christ and the divine can tolerate the suffering that's on planet Earth. They can hold the stillness with the hiccups and the coughs and the bumps of life. They see the end of the story, they see the bigger picture, and they're able to tolerate and not react to every single thing that's going through. Okay, so I'm now back in my guest room meditating. Again, I've been there maybe 10 days, and I start hearing in my meditation, Kerala, which I didn't know then, but it's another part of India. And then I would hear, we are sending you to Kerala. And I would say, you are not sending me to Kerala. You must be sending somebody else, because I have just now gotten safe here and I'm not going to go anywhere else. And I would hear in the meditation, we are sending you to Kerala because we would like to give you the gift of beauty. And I would say back in the meditation, it's not going to happen. Send somebody else. Eventually, it got strong enough that I went to an internet cafe and I Googled about Kerala. And I said to my husband, you know what? I think I might be going 12 hours across India to some other place to look for beauty. And he's going, ah. But I find a little travel agency and I say, what would it cost to send me with a driver? And in the meditation, I hear, going to Kerala is like driving from Little Rock to Asheville. It's only 12 hours. And it's like they're trying to shrink my world and make it more manageable. So anyway, I find that I can hire a driver with a car for a reasonable amount of money and that he will stay with me the whole time. And I said, I want to meet the driver and I want to check out the car. So I met the driver. I knew I would be safe with him. I checked out the car. I thought I was safe. And so I'm getting myself ready to go and the front desk calls me in and says, you have to leave tomorrow. Now, I'm already getting ready to go, but I tune up to cry. I mean, like, big tears. Like, but I've got my email. You told me I can stay. This is my place. And they said, it's the 100th anniversary of Sri Aurobindo's arrival in Pondicherry. People are coming from all over the world, and we need your room. Well, I had two or three exchanges. So I'm fighting for a room that I want to give up. And I'm getting my feelings hurt, and I'm feeling scared over a place I need to leave anyway. And as I walk back to the room, the same little guy, the same little bike guy, sees my tears and he calls me in and he says, don't cry. I see into your heart. This is the man. I see into your heart. I see that you're here only for God. You do not need to cry. The mother is going to take care of you. She's holding you in her hand. She loves you. And when he was nice to me, I tuned up to cry again because he was being so nice. Then he pulled out of his drawer a tablet that has all of his quotes from when the mother was alive. And he said, see, I have opened it up to just the page you need. You need to learn about spiritual immobility. You need to not react. The mother loves you. Okay. To wrap this story up, I go to Kerala, 12 hours across the state. I'm going to end up, across the country, I'm going to end up being there during Easter. And when I arrive, this is the family with whom I'm going to stay. I found it on the internet. It's a homestay. I land in a Christian family's home for the weekend of Easter. Of course, what else would happen? And they take me into the jungle to their worship place, and it was an amazing experience. And here's some of the places of beauty that I saw. Once I got to Kerala, the very unusual religious experiences settled down, and I think my brain needed a rest. So I was really there to pray, to hang out, but not to have wild religious experiences. And I had so much fun, you cannot believe it. So this is a woman that I met that I hung out with for a couple of days. This is some of the beauty in the tea plantations. More beauty in the tea plantations. More beauty in the tea plantations. And one, I'll go back to that one in a minute. One day I'm riding home with the driver took me around to see stuff every day. And at the end of one of the days, he looked at me. He said, you make program yesterday? I make program tomorrow? I said, yeah, you make program tomorrow. So the next day, he takes me to see beautiful stuff. And the end of the day, he says, you want to ride an elephant? I said, by that time, I was feeling no pain. I said, yeah, you bet. I would like to ride an elephant. And he said, I know a man who has an elephant named Lakshmi, which means wealth. You give him some money, he's going to let you ride his elephant. He has a jungle behind his house. Okay, so I go ride the elephant. Look at what a good time I'm having. This is the family with whom I'm staying. And look at the joy on my face. I was told, you're gonna get joy. And I got a large dose of it, okay? So I have five more minutes. I'm going to segue to the next adventure. I come back. So that was in March, about a year ago. And I come back, and I am like in love with Auroville, in love with Pondicherry, in love with the guest house. I cannot wait to go back. I'm like, I just cannot wait to go back to Pondicherry. And in June of last year, in the middle of meditation, I hear Mysore. And I knew Mysore was a town in India. I didn't think it was a fruit tree in Florida. And I just didn't pay attention to it. And the next day I heard Mysore. And two or three days later, I heard Mysore again and again and again, and I realized, oh my Lord, I'm being sent to a different place. And in that series of meditations starting last June and July, I was told in the meditations that I was being sent to another ashram. So I went on a website about Mysore, and there are several ashrams around there. And I found a photograph of a particular man who has an ashram there. I'd never heard of him. And I looked at it and I said, this guy's trustworthy. So if I ever go to Mysore, I will go to this guy's ashram. Then I began to order some of his music and to read about him. So his name is Sri, and this is all on your handout, Sri Ganapati Sachidananda Swamiji. My daughter now calls me Mamiji. And I was told, raced, go to the big guy, and he's a little bit big, he has a little bit of a tummy, but he's so adorable. Run to the big guy with open arms as fast as you can get there. Well, I was in the middle of working with my daughter's wedding, and it was going to be a while before I could get there. And eventually, what began to happen is I began to be given a date of when I was supposed to go to Mysore. And I would say to myself, what the heck difference does it make? I kept being told, you're going to go right before your 60th birthday. That was October the 12th. So the wedding was in September the 26th. I was told, you're going to go right before your 60th birthday. And then I kept being told, October the 6th, October the 6th. So I called. I got myself another airline ticket. And if you leave on October the 6th, you get into India like early in the morning on October the 8th. So eventually, I went to the ashram website, to the calendar, and thought, what difference does it make that I go on October the 8th? Well, Swamiji has ashrams all over the world, but Mysore is his home ashram. And he's made 105 CDs. They're all on iTunes. He's a music dude. He's 70 years old. And I look at the calendar, and it says, Swamiji will be in his home ashram to celebrate the 9 days of Navaratri, the celebration of the divine feminine, starting on October the 8th. So I learned that Swamiji has been worshiping the divine feminine every morning since he was a tiny child. His mother taught him to do that. And I am going to end up in Mysore on the day that Navaratri starts. So I leave Arkansas in October. One plane is delayed. My bag doesn't get there. When I arrive in this town, Bangalore, 3 hours away from Mysore, and I get in a taxi, I say to the taxi driver, no reason to take me to the hotel. At that time, I hadn't been able to get a room in the ashram. I got one later, but I started in a hotel. Don't take me to the hotel. I just have my backpack. Just take me straight to the ashram. He takes me straight to the ashram, and this is what I see. I see silk hanging over a block and a half road. I see a red path that's covered with flowers and people everywhere. We started out with 2,000. By the end of the week, we had 5,000. Flower mandalas, music, incense, gorgeous saris. And I say to, you take off your shoes. As soon as I got on the ashram property and I took off my shoes, I heard a little voice say, I am home. And I say to myself, I am so not home. I have no idea whoever is talking, but I am not home. And I hear, I am home. And I say to the person next to me, what's going on? He said, don't you understand? Swamiji is about to walk in on these flower mandalas, and this is the first day of Navaratri, and he's going to be in here in 5 minutes. So I have left my house in Little Rock, Arkansas. Now I'm 35 or 40 hours later. And the next stop is my bare feet on ashram soil. So we'll talk more about what happened in Mysore. We'll take a little break. After Mysore, I got sent to the Himalayas, to the Buddhist, on another trip I didn't particularly want to go on, but it turned out great. And let's take about a 15-minute break.